Okay, so I'm here with my very dear friend, Venerable Brahmali, and I just want to say, how's it going, Venerable?
Going well, then.
Yeah? How's things over there in Perth?
Things are rainy. It's raining this morning, which is really unusual. So that is very, very good news. And apart from that, we're hoping to get Ajahn Brahm on. It's a bit unsure if he will make it or not, because it's a bit, you know, what these things are like, but... that's kind of the theory anyway. Yeah.
I know what Ajahn's are like. Yes.
Yeah. So, yes.
Anyway, look, great to have you on board. And thanks so much for coming along and doing this with me. So I wanted to just spend some time to talk about, mostly about the translation work that we've been doing. But I'd like to just give a brief introduction to the more technical sides of what we've been doing with sort of Central over the last while, and just give a brief preview of the new updated site. So you already saw some glimpses of that on the little video, and you can see some of the capabilities that we have in terms of say internationalization, showing the user interface in different languages, and various kinds of improvements. One of the things that has been the core motivation for me in doing this work has been the understanding that in Buddhism we have such an incredible sacred literature, and our texts, our suttas, and the teachings in our traditions inform all of the varieties of Buddhism and all of the Buddhist traditions. And yet our Buddhist traditions typically, and with fairly, you know, rare exceptions, don't actually really know what's in our sacred scripture. We don't read the suttas. We don't put a lot of time and effort into them. And if we do anything with them, typically they get put into a cabinet that's very pretty and then put on the shrine and then locked. And if you ask for where the key is, you're liable to be disappointed. When I was studying and looking for these things online, I kept looking for resources. And I kept, you know, there's all these kind of limitations in the resources. And I think we, perhaps most Buddhists don't really realize how little energy and support there is for actually working in this field. There aren't any big institutions, big universities and so on that are doing major long-term projects in this field, with a few exceptions. You know, one exception, of course, being the Sibeta project and the SAT project for the Chinese Tripitaka, and there are a few projects like that. But for the most part, translations of suttas are done by individuals who might be like a volunteer. Say in Norway, you have the translator, what's his name, Leah? How do you pronounce it?
Lee.
Yeah. And he's been working, I understand, more or less just by himself there in Norway, doing good translations into Norwegian. But, you know, there's no institutional support, there's no backup, and there's no sort of coordinated effort in the Buddhist community to actually do these things. Almost all of it's done on a volunteer basis by different Buddhist groups or individuals in different places. And, you know, for me, one of the inspirations for doing the work we did was when I got my first mobile phone. And the first thing that I did on my phone was to try to download a Tripitaka app so I could read the suttas on my phone. And I was really disappointed that the apps I could get weren't very good. And I was like, what's going on? So I thought, well, I'll check out the competition. So I downloaded a Bible app. And wow, it was amazing, right? You could do all of these things, and it was had all of these features, and it was a very cool app that you could use. And, you know, if we want to present Buddhism well in the modern world, we have to demonstrate that we care about our teachings. We can't expect people to take it on faith that the Buddha's teachings are worth listening to if we can't even be bothered to present, you know, complete translations or accurate translations, or if we can't even be bothered to put the time and effort into making a decent application to show them. It tells us something about how much we care about it. One of the things that I found out when doing this work, just by comparison, in the Bible world, in the southern states of the US, there's a company that does nothing but proofread Bibles. That's it. That's their job. and they have 20 to 30 full-time staff who do nothing but proofread Bibles all day. And that's just proofreading. That's not translating and editing and building the apps and all of those other things that's done. And there are hundreds of millions of dollars which are poured into that field of translation and production of Bibles every year. Hundreds of millions of dollars. Yet in Buddhism, we have a few small groups, sort of central, it's just us and a few friends. We have enough to pay a couple of developers and we sponsor one translator to do some work, Charles Patton. We're giving him a little bit of sponsorship money to help him do his work. But we have very few resources, and we do a lot with those resources because we rely heavily on volunteers to do the work. And so the work that we're doing is sort of central, is we want to try to support and empower the community to create better and more readable translations of suttas that will be usable by everyone. And so this is really our aim. And I'll just give a quick demonstration of what we've been working with. And I'm going to do a screen share. So hopefully this will work. Let's see. Desktop Chrome. Share this. Okay, can we see the screen there?
Yes, I think.
We have. Okay, good. All right, so here is the updated version of our sort of central website. And as you can see, more or less the same, but we've introduced a number of new features, new navigation, and these kinds of things. One of the basic things that I've always wanted to do was we should have, if you want to find something, you should always be able to find the original text and the translation, and you should have some kind of description that tells you what it is, because most people don't know what these things are. And so a new navigation system, then this is what we have. You can see the title, and you can see the original language title. You can see a translation of it. This is not all correct yet because we're still building it. This is just in process. So not everything's working and proper here, but this is, you see the basic idea. And you have a little description, so you can see, okay, what is the Digha Nikaya and what are the other collections that are found here. And so this is giving you much more information about how what these things are and how to get there. We have an essay. If you want to learn more about it, then you can read those things. And even all of the little sections and chapters and so on have little descriptive passages that will tell you what's in all of these things. Then we have here what we call a suttaplex. And suttaplex is a complex of information about a sutta. And here we have the title, English, the translation, various translations in other languages. If you want to read it in Hebrew or Norwegian or Sinhala or Thai, then you can. And we also have the list of parallels. So this is telling us where there are similar or related suttas and passages in other languages, Sanskrit, Chinese, sometimes also other similar passages within the Pali text. Sometimes things are referred to. So this one here, you can hover over there and that will tell you what kind of thing it is. So this is a mention. So this is where this sutta is mentioned in this other sutta. So that's interesting because the fact that this particular sutta, Digha Nikaya number one, is mentioned quite a few times elsewhere in the canon is interesting. That means that this was a text which was read and discussed in the early tradition and that they regarded it as important. So these are the this is the basic navigation, and then we have, of course, the sutta itself. And let's see about this. Then we can see this with line by line, side by side, and so on. And so we have various kinds of tools and capabilities. Hopefully these will work. Like I said, this is just a staging site, so not a thing, everything always works. So there you go. And you can see the meaning of the Pali words by clicking on these. So this is giving you an idea of some of the features that we're having in Sutta Central. And any of you who have been involved with programming and especially modern web development will know that it's very complicated. Oh my goodness. so many things, browser incompatibilities and all of this stuff. Anyway, so hopefully our job is to try to deal with all of those complications and give you the opportunity to read these suttas when you like. Now, you see these suttas here, this particular sutta, this is a translation that I made, and this is when I spent my 2.5 years in Taiwan, in the little island of Chi Mei. Oh, I should say that on that time I was sponsored by Dustin and Gecko and their family, and I should also mention that Gecko, one of the major sponsors of my time at the island, just passed away about a week ago. So very, very sad to hear that. She was a very amazing woman. So I'd like to offer the merit for today's event to Gecko and her family. Here we can also see variant readings. So that's nice. And we can see the variant readings in different ways. So that's also nice. Example, I can show these as side notes. I can do this side by side. So there you go. If I want to see the variant readings out there like that. So these are all some of the capabilities which we're building and which we're making possible. Now, these segments, you see that this is like matching Pali and the English. There's a roughly approximately matching. It's never exactly matching. But that's being done through... Sorry, I've got these annoying Zoom things which are messing up my tabs here. Hang on, I'll have to do this. Go away, Zoom. Sorry, I can't get to these tabs because the Zoom is in the way. Whose idea was that? Sorry, I'm just going randomly here. Oh, okay, here we go. So this is an app that we've also been building called Bilara. And Bilara is the Pali word for cat. And this particular translation is a computer-assisted translation, C-A-T. So you can see we are capable of multilingual puns. Now, what this does is this is a web application which enables translators to do their work. And Venerable Brahmali's been working on this. And I just want to say, to Venerable, thank you so much for your patience. You're one of our alpha testers, and you've been with it this whole time. And it's getting to a pretty good state now. But yeah, we've developed it. So what happens is you just translate it segment by segment. And as you click that one, you can see, aha, this particular segment has been translated before. And so I can see, there we go. And I can just click there and bingo. There we go. That's one. So unfortunately, I've chosen a rather violent one. Here's some children hurting some fish. It's just an accident, okay? But there you go. And he saw the birds, saw the boys hitting this. And I can do this one, but instead I can just change this translation. I should translate tormenting, keep it consistent, tormenting. And there you go. So that's how translation is done. And this is what Venerable Brahmali, myself, and other volunteers have been doing working on Bilara. And you can see that the Bilara, even though we're just getting beginning, we already have a number of translations here. So particularly the Japanese, German, Portuguese, Russian, Burmese, and Czech. We've all made a start in all of those languages, and we hope to extend that over time. So this is the essence of the work that we're doing, and because we're building quite a complex system to do all of these translations and to get them through to the website and handle them in all the different ways that we need to do, then it becomes quite a complex technical challenge. So that is what I have for you right now. What I'd like to maybe do is invite Venerable Brahmali to speak, and we can maybe talk. I think what's more interesting and more important long term is to talk about the translation work that we've been doing. So I'll try to stop screen sharing. I'll see. Hopefully that will work. Where am I now? I don't know how to stop screen sharing. I'll stop sharing. There we go. Bingo. So, Venerable, maybe you want to talk a bit about the translations, and then I'll talk a little bit about a couple of translation things that I wanted to point out, and then we can maybe have some discussion.
Yeah. Okay, can do. So thank you for that, Bantasudha. That was very, very inspiring. It's really nice to see this coming together. And I just want to second what you said at the beginning about the importance of the EBTs. I think this is really, really undervalued in the world. This is the foundation for everything in Buddhism. And nothing in Buddhism makes any sense without the EBTs, because everything refers back to the principles and the ideas that are laid down in the EBTs. And
Clarify, Venerable, EBTs.
Yeah, early Buddhist texts. Okay.
Thank you.
Early Buddhist texts. Okay. So this is the in-house jargon, which sometimes gets lost on people. So that's a good point. And I think it's really incumbent on every Buddhist in the world to have some familiarity with the EBTs, because you cannot really understand your own tradition without having some familiarity with the early Buddhist texts. This is what we see as the word of the Buddha. We think there is very good historical evidence for believing that these ideas in the early Buddhist texts actually are the word of the Buddha. And so it should be really exciting. Yeah, the word of the Buddha, the greatest spiritual master in human history. And this kind of should really be exciting. And that is it for me. So I know what you mean here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I have been doing. And the reason I have been doing what I've been looking at is the Vinaya Pitaka. And the Vinaya Pitaka is like the work on the monastic rules and also the monastic regulations. This is the Vinaya Pitaka. Is there somebody whose microphone is on here? I think someone's microphone might be on. There's a bit of screeching in the background. So when we started this project, Bhantasudhara said to me, okay, I'll translate the suttas, you do the Vinaya. And I said, what do you mean you do the suttas, I do the... You get all the fun. The suttas is the good part, yeah? And I'm stuck with the monastic rules and the monastic regulations. But so that was how it started out. And it's actually quite a fair distribution. Even though the monastic rules are a bit drier than the suttas, they are still very significant for a number of reasons. I'll give you a couple of those reasons. The first reason is that the translations that we have of the Vinaya are not as good as the translations we have of the suttas. They have a lot of defects. I'll come back to those defects very soon. So that's one reason. But the other reason, I think sometimes the Vinaya is undervalued. There's a lot of interesting stories, a lot of interesting information about how to organize Buddhist first of all, the Buddhist Sangha and, you know, the Buddhist monastic community. But by extension, this also has applications for how we should really organize any Buddhist organization in the world. Yeah, it's because these are basic principles laid down by the Buddha again. So actually, I think it is quite fascinating. A lot of interesting stories in there, and also good for lay people to have some idea of what rules we are supposed to follow as monastics. So I'll give you an example of these interesting stories. Yeah, this is a story which is actually quite applicable to the present day. And there are some firsts in the Buddhist Vinaya, which I don't think you find anywhere else in the world, in world literature of that time. It's kind of these are the first mentions of anything like this, as far as I know, anyway, in world literature. And one of them is about trans people. Yeah, so trans people are mentioned in the Vinaya Pitaka. And this, you may think that this is not very significant, but of course it is, because it gives us some guidance how we should deal with trans people in the Sangha in the present day. If you want have someone who wants to get ordained, how should we deal with that? Yeah, and there is a story which deals with this in the Vinaya. And the story is this: there's a monk, yeah, and this monk one day, for whatever reason, he turns into a woman. So we don't know exactly what is going on here, whether this is some kind of miracle, or whether it was a first sex change operation or whatever. We don't know exactly what's happening behind this, but that is kind of beside the point. The main point is that it actually supposedly happened. Yeah, so we have a rule for it. And what the rule is that the moment you change into a woman, at that moment, you belong no longer to the Sangha, the community of monks, but you actually now belong to the community of nuns. Yeah. So at that moment, you transfer, dang, now you are a nun. And then later on, the same thing happened to a nun. Suddenly a nun turned into a man. Yeah. So at that moment, when she turned into a man, she becomes a bhikkhu, she becomes a monk. And now you're turned into the bhikkhu sangha. So that tells us, yeah, very clearly how we should deal with trans people in the present day if they want to join in the sangha. It's very clear why this is happening. But there's another reason why this is very fascinating here. And many of you probably will know about the ordination of nuns, of bhikkhunis, that we had in Perth in 2009. Yeah. So prior to that ordination, we had a lot of discussion about how to go about the ordination, what was the best way to restart the bhikkhuni sangha within the forest tradition and all of that. And so we discussed various options, yeah? And Bhante Sujata was one of the foremost people, maybe the foremost people within our community anyway, to discuss these things. And Ajahn Brahm said, well, there is one really good way of doing this, yeah? And this is to get 5 months to have a sex change, and then bang, you have a bhikkhuni sangha straight away here. Yeah? So this was kind of, so it has practical applications, yeah? All you have to do is have a sex change and bang, you have a bhikkhuni sangha, and no one can fault that because actually it is laid down in the Vinaya Pitaka. So that may sound cheeky on the surface of it, but I actually thought about it later on, is if you look at the, you know, very large sangha or bhikkhus or monks around the world, there are hundreds of thousands of bhikkhus around the world. And I think it's fairly obvious that there will be some of those bhikkhus who are not happy with their gender. Yeah, this is just a certain percentage in the population. So if you could get the word out there, well, if you're not happy with the gender, we will sponsor, you know, gender reassignment if that's what you want. And then bang, maybe you would have a bhikkhuni sangha. So this would have been maybe one way of doing it. Might be a bit controversial. So maybe it wouldn't have been the best way, but it shows you that there are some strange possibilities within the Vinaya Pitaka. So that is just to give you some idea that there is some interesting things in the Vinaya. It's not entirely boring and gray and depressing and all of that. Some of it is pretty depressing, but some of it actually is also very interesting. Yeah. It's depressing because it shows the defilements of human beings. Yeah. But let me now move on to show you why it really matters to make a new translation. I'm going to try to share my screen like Bhante Sujata did before to see if I'm capable of doing this. And I'm going to show you some of the problems. Let's see here. This is no good. This is not what I want to show. Okay, so this is it's a little bit bumpy because there were some transfer problems. Can everyone see the screen? Yeah? Are you still there?
Yes, Bhante.
Okay, great. Okay. So this is just, these are some of the reasons why the existing translation is, in my opinion, so unsatisfactory. Yeah? So I've lost the Pali text there. I had the Pali text at the top. Not sure what happened to it. But so here, you have a translation, first of all, the existing translation, and you have my translation underneath, yeah? So the existing translation, just to read it out to you, is whoever should betake himself to the neighborhood of a village, sin would besmirch him. And I think that we can all agree that that sounds like something out of the 19th century, yeah? It sounds really ancient, and it sounds almost, it's comprehensible, but only barely so. I think some people might have to kind of look up a word like besmirch because it's not really obvious. So here you have a more modern translation. Whoever stays near an inhabited area would commit an offense. So that is shows you part of the problem with having a translation that was done back in the 1930s. This comes back from the 1930s because it is barely comprehensible to a modern audience. That is one problem, yeah? So here we have another problem, the fact that the text is overly literal. You can see the Pali there. If you see the Pali at the top, the Pali is very repetitive. And then when Ivy Horner has translated the Pali, she has basically repeated all the repetition, just verbatim. And you get a very clunky sentence like as follows, Lord, if a monk wishes to undertake an undertaking on his own behalf, endowed with how many qualities is the undertaking that he may undertake on his own behalf? Yeah, very clunky. And in my opinion is that it is barely a proper translation because it's not how you would phrase things in English. We should use natural English language to express these things so that they are easily accessible, etc. So this would be the more appropriate translation. Yeah, Venerable Sir, if a monk wishes to raise an issue, what factors should be fulfilled? Yeah, fairly straightforward and easy to understand.
Venerable, sorry to interrupt, but just to, if I just might say, you said that the translations are made in the 30s and are archaic. I think it's worth noting that they were already archaic in the 30s.
Yeah.
Some of the translations, Parivara was published in the 60s, so it's actually contemporary with the Beatles. These are things which were, they were sort of consciously phrased in a way that was archaic even for the time.
Yeah, I think the idea was that these were religious teachings, spiritual teachings, and as they were kind of put on a pedestal, and so used old-fashioned language to actually make it more, give it a kind of air or something special. But really, I think that's not the point. I think that the point is that the Buddha, he taught ordinary people, and ordinary people need ordinary language to understand what is going on. And so, So let's move on. So here I got on to the third reason why a new translation is important, and this is that sometimes the old translations have very serious mistakes in it. And here is one of them. This Pali here is a bit ambiguous, and that's why Ivy Horn has got it wrong. But she actually, it's not just wrong, it's fairly obviously wrong. Do not let the order suffer is her translation. But really what it means is something like as follows: what belongs to the Sangha should not be allowed to deteriorate. Yeah, so you can see it pretty, very, very different. Yeah, and it's, you can see there's a very consequential, if you have these kind of differences and actually apply to rules for the Sangha, for the monastic community, then you don't really know what you're doing. Yeah, you kind of have no idea what's happening. And that's kind of, so that matters for the practice of these teachings.
And I should note, from a monastic point of view, what that effectively means is that monks and nuns then don't read it, or you don't try to follow it because you think it's incomprehensible, you can't make sense of it, so you just instead you rely on what somebody else says or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So it is really important to have a clarity in the teachings and what's going on. Yeah. So here is another example. Ananda, these followers of other sects, although liable to poor guardianship. Yeah, so that's okay. Kind of strange, right? Strange sentence, but so this is the actual proper translation. Yeah, even the ascetics of other religions with their flawed teachings. Yeah, that's actually a proper translation. And you may wonder, how is it possible to get it so wrong here? And the reason is very simple, because if you look at the Pali up there, it says Durakkata Dhamma. And she has taken that to mean du plus rakkata instead of dur plus akkata. So she has taken it as the wrong word, and that is why she gets this kind of seriously flawed translation here. Okay, let's move on. Oops, what happened now? I think I... Yeah, so now I want to look at... Okay, sorry. So... Now I'm going to look more at how to do the translation. We have seen the mistakes or the problems with Ivy Horner's translation, and there's actually many more problems as well. Another big problem with Ivy Horner is that she has left out large parts of the Pali. And the reason she left it out was because it didn't fit with the sensibilities of the Victorian age, basically. 1930s was obviously post-Victorian, but they still had some of those Victorian attitudes were still prevalent at that time. So because of that, they left out all of the sexual things. Yeah, and of course, the sexual things are actually matter a lot for a monastic community which is celibate. You really need to know what those things are so you can follow the rules properly. But she left all of those things out. And Bhante Sujato, he suggested to me I should include some racy passages from the Vinaya to show some of those things. And I had a quick look through it, but I couldn't really find anything I felt was suitable, so I left it out. But now at least everything is translated. And one of the interesting things about translating things that are of a sexual nature is that not to make it kind of explicit or make it kind of titillating. It shouldn't be that. It should be very matter of fact. It should be kind of straight to the point, because the purpose is to inform. The purpose should not be to kind of make some text which is kind of interesting because of all the kind of weird stuff going on. Yeah, that's kind of an important thing there. So I try to phrase things carefully so I should make them neutral in terms of language, even though it's quite sexually explicit at certain times. But so those are the problems with I.B. Horner. So very briefly, I should hurry up now, Bante, because I need you to give you some time as well. Some ideas on translation. One of the main ideas with translating is to get the text from Pali into idiomatic English. Yeah, English that people can understand, using ordinary words, using straightforward language, nothing fancy, as simple as possible, etc., etc. And an important part of doing that is to actually translate the meaning of a sentence. Yeah. So instead of looking at individual words, you try to focus on sentence, complete sentences or complete paragraphs or even complete passages. You extract the meaning. Once you understand the meaning, then you go back and you translate. And then when you translate, you try not to look too much at the Pali, because if you look too much at the Pali, you tend to come out with a Pali kind of structure. And it sounds like Buddhist hybrid English or something like that. So it sounds like a language which is not proper English, and it actually sounds really weird and funny. So one example of this would be, for example, when I translate the word matika, which you can see on the screen there. And matika is really means clay. That's kind of the root meaning of this word. Yeah, that's the substance. And sometimes you have to translate according to the substance. But matika also is used in the suttas as a cleaning agent, yeah, to clean your body specifically. And that is the function of matika. And because that is a function, to give that meaning into English, you actually have to translate according to function, and so I translate as soap rather than as clay. Traditionally, this would always have been translated as clay, which to my mind doesn't really give the meaning in English. But when you differentiate that word into two subparts like that, and the difference is quite clear throughout the Vinayapitaka, so it's quite easy to differentiate, and then you have two translations for the same word. And I think that is very important to understand that words have fairly clearly defined meanings in different contexts. You have to pull those apart and then translate differently. Then you get a really nice and fluent translation as a consequence. Another example you can see on the screen there is the word danta katta, yeah, which means tooth wood in Pali, quite literally. But of course, it is equivalent to what we now have as a toothbrush. Yeah, so the appropriate rendering would be toothbrush. But if you read most translations, they will indeed have tooth wood in that particular place. Then another principle of translation is that quite often you have to do quite a bit of your own research. Yeah, because if you don't do your own research, often there is no research existing on many of these words. So you have to get into the nitty-gritty sometimes to find out, you know, the real underlying meaning of these things. And a very important word, obviously, when you translate the Vinaya Pitaka, then the word Vinaya is obviously very significant, yeah? You can't get away with not translating this word in a meaningful way. And one of the main meanings of Vinaya is monastic law. It refers to that collection of scriptures on the monastic law. That is a very important translation. And I.B. Horner translates it as a discipline, which is fine. It maybe comes out a bit too harsh to modern ears, but so I prefer monastic law for that term. But the problem is that even though that is how we now understand the word Vinaya, we need to ask ourselves, how was this word understood at the very beginning when they started out? This was a word that was taken from the existing Indian context, the culture of India at the time, and it had a different meaning. The word Vinaya was also spoken about other schools or other religions, other sects that existed in India at the time. And if you look at the evidence, you will see that the word vinaya very often means training, both in the sutras and also in the vinaya. It is, for example, you train a horse. It is what you do is you vinati that horse. You train it. Obviously, it doesn't mean monastic law when you are training a horse. Yeah, it must mean something else. So you have to distinguish vinaya. Sometimes training, sometimes monastic law, and that will give you an idea of the chronological layers in that text to show that there is an evolution within the text itself, where language shifts over time, which is actually very fascinating and interesting here. I'm taking a lot of time, so please stop me if I go too long. Yeah.
No, but that one's an interesting one, especially in the context of the suttas, because in the suttas also Dhamma Vinaya is almost always translated as, as if it's suttas and the Vinaya.
Yeah.
In fact, it almost always means basically teaching and training, or theory and practice in a way.
Yeah.
And it needs to be translated in that case. There are other similar cases. Another one is Pabbajeti Upasampadeti, which translated as if it referred to two different stages. You take the going forth and then take the full ordination. In fact, in the suttas, almost always it refers to just one thing. It just refers to ordaining.
Yeah.
And those two stages might recognize there. So these are some of the cases where it's very easy to bring those assumptions into the suttas, and we, in a sense, we have to translate it to deconstruct the assumptions that people are going to bring into it.
That's very true. And I was actually going to talk about Dhamma Vinaya as well, but I had to take out some of the material because I realized I had too much. But the word Dhamma Vinaya is actually used as a the different sects in India, they each had a Dhamma Vinaya. If you find that in the Vinaya Pitaka itself, it actually says that the Dhamma Vinaya of this school, Dhamma Vinaya of that school, so obviously it cannot mean the monastic law, because a lot of these schools, there's no evidence that they even had a monastic law, or they had any kind of clear rules, but they certainly had a kind of training. There was something that you had to do. So obviously it cannot mean monastic law in the ordinary sense. The next one, very, very briefly, a word pasada, which I did a bit of research into, and it is usually translated as something like palace or mansion in the Vinaya. And the reason for that is because of the commentaries they talk about these very grand buildings that were built. Migaras pasada is said to have 7, 9, or 11 levels. Yeah, and so it was an enormous house, according to the commentaries, and I don't think that is very reliable at all. So if you really do your research properly, and that's what I did, it becomes fairly clear that what it refers to is a stilt house, because this must have been a fairly common way of constructing in ancient India, especially when they made houses out of wood, which was the main thing at that time. And so that becomes a new translation. And you may wonder, does this really matter? And it does sometimes, because one of the problems with palace, it makes things sound very grand. Yeah, the Buddha lived in a pasada when he was a child. Did he live in a palace? No, there is actually very little evidence for that. But did he live in a stilt house? That makes much more sense. That makes us understand the situation of the Buddha in a much more realistic fashion when we get the realistic meaning of these particular terms. Otherwise, we buy into the later tradition where the Buddha was a magnificent prince whose father was a king. They live in this magnificent capital, Kapilavastu, with millions of people and all of this kind of stuff, which is a later mythology built upon the earliest suttas. Then there is an interesting one for January. Yeah, please.
Can I interrupt you there? Because we are going to run out of time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, please.
We'll want to hear that, but I'd like to just say a few things and then maybe get to some of the questions, because we've got a few
minutes. There's also Ajahn Brahm might be coming in for a couple of minutes any second now, so let's maybe keep that in mind as well here. Hello, are you there, Mansurata?
We can hear.
Am I back?
Yes.
Okay. So I think I just dropped out. I think my Wi-Fi just dropped out. Is Ajahn Brahmali still there? Yes, he's there now.
I'm here. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think my Wi-Fi just collapsed for a bit. So shall I go ahead with doing my screen sharing?
You can, but I was just saying that I'm not sure if Ajahn Brahm will come on. I'm just not sure what's happening with him. But
that's all right. That's all right. We can look over to you if he comes along. That's fine.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So I just want to just share a couple of things about my Sutta translations. And as Venerable mentioned, one of the differences between the Sutta translations and Vinaya translations is that we have more generations of Sutta translations. More work has been done in it. As a result, the translations are generally speaking of better quality. And of course, we have the excellent translations of Bhikkhu Bodhi and K.R. Norman and Venerable Ananda Jyoti and others whose work we can build on. So I didn't find, when I was doing my translations, I didn't find so many obvious mistakes in the earlier translations like Venerable Brahmali did. There are a few cases where you find different mistakes, but it's more a case of improving things, trying to improve the phrasing, trying to make things more consistent, making them more clear, and trying to clarify a lot of quite obscure points and points that might be of some kind of interest, but just small little details. So I'm just going to mention here a couple of small details, because a lot of the work that we do is not in big, exciting things, but in very small things. But I find those small details important because, to me, it reflects the integrity and the care that we put into the work, every small little detail. Now, so this is one case, Majjhima Nikaya number 122, the longer discourse on emptiness. We have a simile. Here's Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. I shall not treat you as the potter treats the raw, damp clay. Repeatedly restraining you, I shall speak to you, Ananda, repeatedly admonishing you, I shall speak to you. The sound call will stand the test. And he gives the translation from the commentary. And the problem is that this isn't, the simile is not very vivid. Like, what is actually the point of the simile? Usually in the suttas, the similes convey the meaning that they're trying to convey in a very clear and unambiguous way. There's been some discussion about that, reference to some Sanskrit parallels for it, different verbs and so on. And so I came up with another translation. So, Ananda, treat me as a friend, not as an enemy. That will be for your lasting welfare and happiness. I shall not mollycoddle you like a potter with their damp, unfired pots. I shall speak, correcting you again and again, pressing you again and again. The core will stand the test. So this, it seems to me, is a much more meaningful simile, right? So the simile now is very clear that when a potter has made their pots, but they're still damp, they haven't been fired, then they're very fragile. So the potter has to look after them very carefully. But the Buddha's not going to do that with Ananda. He's going to tell him what's what, right? So if Ananda messes up, the Buddha's going to be on his back, right? So this is the force of that simile there. So that's just one case where I think that I've managed to clarify the meaning and the sense of that little simile. And I'm just going to mention one more similar passage before going into the more discussion. And this is a question of an image that appears in the Chakravati Sihanada Sutta. So the Chakravati Sihanada Sutta is one of the most interesting texts in Buddhism, not least because it introduces the Buddha Maitreya, or known in Sanskrit as Maitreya. And this is the only occasion when Maitreya is mentioned in the early Buddhist texts. And of course, it's very interesting in terms of the great impact that this has had on later traditions. Now, without going into all of the details of this, but there's one passage here where it says that King, I'm just having trouble getting my tabs visible. Let me see. Do this. Here we go. Okay, so when the Buddha Maitreya arises long in the future, there will be a wheel-turning monarch at the same time called King Sankha. And according to former translations, King Sankha will raise up the palace. And again, this notion of palaces, made a palace that had been built by King Mahapanada. And this is a very strange sentence in many ways. Who was King Panada? Why should we care about him? What's going on with this, right? Why is he raising up this palace? And the word for palace here is yupa. And yupa is not a normal word for palace at all. And yet that's how it's translated in the commentaries. So one of the things that we find in the commentaries is that by the time the commentaries are written in Sri Lanka, they had little knowledge of the details of the Brahmanical traditions. So they often get those details incorrect. So in this case, a yupa is a specific description of a sacrificial post which is used in the Brahmanical traditions. And you can see here this image. This is a coin which actually gives us a picture of a yupa. And you can see this, there's a horse, which is the horse for the sacrifice, and then above that is the yupa, which is like a kind of post with streamers coming off it, with balls there that would have been decorated for holding it on. And this is actually referenced in another verse in the Theragata. So Theragata is the only other place that refers to King Panada. There was a king named Panada, some legendary king of the past, who had a sacrificial post all golden. Its height was 16 times its width in the top of the southern fold. It has had 1,000 panels and 100 ball caps, all adorned with banners and made with gold. There danced the fairies, the Gandharvas, numbering 7 times 6,000. So again, this is a curious verse in the Theragata. It's very unusual. Most verses in the Theragata are very, you know, I'm going into the forest, I'm going to practice my meditation and so on. And yet we have this allusion here to an ancient legend. And the verse doesn't give us any context. It just tells us this little detail and leaves us to try to make what it is. So obviously there'd be more information given about that in the background story as to why this particular detail is mentioned here. But it does tell us about a little bit about who King Panada is and about what their yupa is. So here, coming back to the Digha Nikaya 26, the Chakravartisi Hinata Sutta, we know that King Sankar was raising the sacrificial post of this legendary king of the past, King Panada, and that sacrificial post is associated with the horse sacrifice. The horse sacrifice is done in order to assert the authority, the divine authority of the king. But here, instead of doing the horse sacrifice at this post, he will give away to ascetics and Brahmins, paupers, vagrants, travelers and beggars. So in other words, he's saying that rather than the king establishing their authority based on performance of the horse sacrifice and based on a cruel ritual, then the king establishes their authority by their kindness and giving and sharing to others. Right? Because they introduce a system of, dare I say it, socialism, and actually having the idea that it's the responsibility of the rulers to care for their subjects. And of course, that's a very Buddhist message. And once you understand that those different parts of the story and the context, then you can sort of put it together and understand why it's referring there to the sacrificial post rather than to a palace.
And that, of course, fits with how it is explained throughout the suttas about, you know, kings moving away from sacrifice and moving towards the Dhamma. This is a common theme that suddenly fits with the Dhamma overall, and it kind of makes
absolutely
sense.
Yeah. You find in the Kutadanta Sutta being the best example of that.
Yes.
And it's still like a, you know, even though, like, okay, we don't see kings doing horse sacrifices, fair enough, but it's still very much a similar thing, right? I mean, these days, you know, rulers, presidents, prime ministers, they love to surround themselves with pomp and ceremony. They love to, you know, have all of the trappings of office that's going to make them look as if they're regal and have all of these kinds of things. But the real authority of a ruler is from how they practically look after their people. And that's a theme right throughout the suttas. And it's just as relevant today as it was then. Okay, so that's just a couple of examples. And, of course, I could have mentioned a lot more examples in terms of, like more technical contexts. So just one technical context, for example, there's a phrase in the suttas, an Anjavi Sankara, or not the Punyavi Sankara, Apunyavi Sankara. Which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as the meritorious volitional formations and demeritorious volitional formations. I think you'll agree is not a term that rolls easily off the tongue, whereas I've translated it as good choices and bad choices. And so again, you know, following very much along the principles that I've learned from Ajahn Brahm and from Venerable Brahmali also, to try to translate it in a way that people would understand. And I always remember, Venerable, the one thing that you said to me years ago when we were discussing this. You said that whatever meaning that a text has, one thing that we can be sure is that it has some meaning, and that leaving aside perhaps rare occasions when there's textual corruption, then the text means something, and we should always translate it as if it meant something. And if we get it wrong, then we can fix it. But we shouldn't translate it in a way that's simply incomprehensible. Mm. Okay. So that's what I had. And yeah. I'll stop sharing.
Yeah. You know, Bhattasiddhanta, one of the things that occurs to me right now, is it okay if I share something?
Yeah. Please, yeah.
Is that one of the points I was going to make just on that slide of mine before you entered was that some of the, you know, the Buddhist texts are very, because it comes from the Indian languages of the time, they are very male-oriented. And you have words, you know, when you use a masculine pronoun or a term that refers to males, very often it doesn't actually just refer to males, but that was the default gender in almost all contexts.
Right.
So I did a bit of research into that. You know, I looked at, for example, the word putta. The putta usually means, is often translated as son, but actually, very often, because it is a male gender, when it occurs in the plural, it actually does not mean son, it means children.
Right.
And this is true across the board. For example, if you have the word, not singular brother, but you have brothers, then right. it means siblings rather than actually brothers.
Right.
And I did some research to make sure I was on the right track, and I found something in the Abhidhamma Padipika, which is the ancient dictionaries of Pali, and that's exactly what it says in there. It says the plural includes both genders. So, for example, this is relevant. It's interesting from a gender point of view because it means that it's not as exclusionary of the female gender as it might look sometimes, the text. Yeah. And I think that is an important point. And then, for example, in the standard formula for the Brahmin of a good birth, the good birth, they have been Brahmins back for seven generations, It uses the word Pitara. Pitara Mahayuga, or something like that. And Pitara is a plural for father, Plural for father also includes mothers. So that should really be mothers and fathers going back seven generations. Just occurred to me now when we're discussing this. And I think that would be an interesting change in translation there for that particular phrase and be more inclusive.
Have a look at that. So, yeah, that's very important. And I also have translated putta as child wherever it seemed appropriate. And you mentioned another one you mentioned is bahata, another one that I introduced in my translation, which is different in your translation, is I use mendicant for bhikkhu. Yeah. And of course, one of the differences there being that in the suttas, most of the time, when the word bhikkhu is being used, it's used in a general sense, that it's just in reference to any of the mendicants who are present. Whereas in the Vinaya, it's usually referring specifically to either the monks' community or the nuns' community. So there it makes sense to translate it as monks and nuns. Whereas in my context, in the suttas, then it makes more sense to translate it as a gender-neutral term. Let's have a look, Venerable, at some of the questions. We'll just have briefly look at those questions. So I think you can see them on your screen there, but I'll just briefly go through them. So Josh has asked, hey, Josh, how are you going? Thanks for the question. What are the Abhidhamma translated? Most of the Abhidhammas being translated into English. We have some of them on Sutta Central. There's Ajahn Brahm. How's it going, Ajahn?
It's terrific. Great. I'm enjoying all you're saying. It's nice to see two people I trained in Vinaya and taught a little bit and how well you're doing. So just carry on. You're doing a great job.
How's things going over there at Bodhnyana?
We're in the wet season now. It just rained a few minutes ago.
Yeah. So that's going to last for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's very good. That's wonderful what you're saying and how great it is that we are translating in an intelligent way and not just putting one Pali word to one English word, putting all these things, and they create a lot of trouble. Of course, you know, I just mentioned it's one of the problems which you all know, which I'm very passionate about, is that even things like in meditation, because I'm a meditation teacher, so many people get stressed out and they don't get the full benefits of meditation simply by mistranslations of calling something like samadhi concentration. That's a terrible word because that's too forceful and creates too much stress inside the meditator. I much prefer the word stillness, and that brings out a much more emotional, correct meaning to what happens when you meditate. You become still. Anyway, so I fully support what you're doing.
And Ajahn, a lot of the sort of the general ideas behind how Brahmali and I are working really is, well, you know, we learned a lot of this from your Vinaya work that you did in the 90s. And then you started sort of really sort of trying to translate things according to their meaning and trying to make sure that that was translated in a way that was clear and comprehensible.
Indeed. This is not just an intellectual exercise. We live the Vinaya.
Yeah.
And we practice meditation. So it's the real life experiences.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's wonderful what you're doing. So carry on.
Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Just to come back to Josh's questions, so the Abhidhamma, so much of the Abhidhamma has been translated. We don't have any specific plans to translate Abhidhamma on Sutta Central. It's not our main focus, but if somebody wants to do it, then they're most welcome to get in touch with us. We're happy to support it. We have the Abhidhamma text there, but we don't actually have plans to do the translation. One of the reasons why is because, see, the problem with Abhidhamma is that because it's mostly technical terms and repetitions and things, translations are of limited use. Actually, the Pali of the Abhidhamma is mostly pretty straightforward. Because it's all technical terms, and if you know a bit of grammar, then the difficulty in Abhidhamma is not the language. So almost anyone who wants to do a serious study of Abhidhamma would probably be better off doing it in Pali. You know, we try our best to like, for me, a translator's role is to be as transparent as possible. And so I'm always like, you know, if the Buddha was there saying this, what would the Buddha say in English? And the hard part about translation is always the target language, what you're translating into. Understanding the Pali, yes, has difficulties and can be knotty sometimes, but mostly that's the easier part. The hard part is to figure out how do you want to express that. And another question here is, are poetic descriptions and metaphors in the suttas translated in any significant different manner compared with other translation work? I mentioned just one example of where I changed the translation of a metaphor. I don't want to do too much of an adaptive translation. So I sort of keep the metaphors grounded in the sort of the experience and the culture and the time and the place that was there at the time of the Buddha. But obviously you want to try to express that in a way that is as vivid as possible. I did sort of try to make things like botanical names, names of animals, all of these things. I've tried to translate everything. One difference between my translation and earlier translations is that it includes almost no Pali in the translation. And whereas previous translations, you can easily end up with something like, you know, the bhikkhu was sitting samadhi and a deva came to him, and you don't realize that actually all of the main words in the sentence are actually in Pali. So I would always translate everything unless you really, really can't. That was my approach.
I was just thinking about you talking about translating everything. I was thinking of a word like Anjali, which is a very kind of specific Indian word. And whenever you translate it, it becomes both clunky and inaccurate at the same time. And how I can't remember now. How do you resolve that in your...
With palms together or something like that?
But doesn't really kind of convey the full meaning, does it? It works as a shorthand, but doesn't really convey the full meaning. Palms together could mean anything.
Well, Anjali is a good case because in that case it does mean the same thing now as it did then.
Yeah.
So in that case, there's an argument for it. One of the big problems with leaving words in the original language is that usually the word means something different today than it did in the Buddha's time. And we already mentioned one example before with Vinaya, which today always means the rules for the monks and nuns. In the Buddha's day, that was just one of the meanings among several. And every, you know, samadhi is the same, bodhisattva is the same. You know, all of these words have different ranges of meanings today. Even something like bhikkhu has a different kind of meaning today than it did then. You know, in modern Sri Lanka, for example, bhikkhu is usually translated as priest, but it certainly didn't mean priest in those days, it means mendicant. But then the problem is that in Sri Lanka, most of the bhikkhus don't go for alms round. So what does it mean to be a mendicant? But that's what the name means. The name means somebody who goes for alms round. And so to try to point to like what is the actual meaning of that word specifically in that context. So for me, like you know, you always try to make it so that it's clear and that it sounds nice and all of those kinds of things, but the accuracy must be first. That's you can't compromise with that.
Yeah. And that is one of the things I learned from you, the idea that we should translate everything so that the text is transparent and people know what is there.
Right.
And I think there are some words like Buddha you don't actually need to translate because it's just so common.
That's an English word, yeah.
Yeah, so there are maybe there's only about two or three words that that you actually lead like that. And
So, Venerable, I think we've got a few things on the chat. Questions here. Q&A. Are we booked more time? So we have some more time if we're going. So, Venerable Carlico's given a link there. Thanks, Venerable, for some essays that I wrote, mostly myself, but also Venerable Brahmali and I Wimala also wrote some as well on different aspects of the translation that we have encountered. Somebody, an anonymous attendee, has asked, do we see any value in the critical edition of the Pali Canon? And my answer to that is no. But that would need some explanation for those who aren't sure what the critical edition means. Critical edition is a concept that's used in editing ancient works where you have multiple copies of that work. So what it means is that a modern editor will sit down with all, ideally, or at least a representative sample of the sources for that work, and will compile a modern edition which will critically assess the manuscripts of the past, adjust and change and correct them as necessary, and will maintain detailed notes as to exactly what's found in all of the editions and all of the changes that have been made and so on. The editions of the Pali Text Society are kind of demi-critical editions. They kind of use that sort of approach, but they don't really apply it in a very kind of thorough and complete manner, so they're not really regarded as exemplary critical editions, but they're certainly a step towards a critical edition. The problem with that approach is that it's typically used in cases where you have a relatively small number of manuscripts and a relatively large amount of time to spend assessing it and doing all of the expert work. And that's the case in Pali is very different. We have a very large number of manuscripts, hundreds of them, probably thousands of manuscripts. Nobody can assess them all. We have a very small number of people working in the field. We have a very small number of people who are actually qualified to do that kind of work. And to be clear, I certainly would not regard myself as being qualified to do that work. It's a different set of skills to the set of skills that I've developed. So the idea that we can that we then have to entrust a tiny circle of editors to this massive monumental task of editing these things, I think it's a fantasy. If we look at the history of Pali texts, a good example is the Critical Pali Dictionary, which attempted to do the same thing for a dictionary. And if you go to the Critical Pali Dictionary websites on the homepage, the most prominent feature is the list is the obituaries. All of the scholars since the 19th century who have died, meanwhile, they're up to the letter K, which is like the first consonant in the Pali alphabet. All right? And I think that an attempt to do a proper critical edition of the Pali Canon is really doomed to have that same kind of thing. It's not necessary. What we should be doing, in my view, is creating what they call diplomatic editions. And a diplomatic edition is where you literally create, letter for letter, exactly what is in the manuscript without any editorial intervention whatsoever. So it's not us who decide what's correct and what's not correct in the manuscript. We simply say, this is what is in the manuscript. Then later scholars can look at it and compare the different texts, and then they can know and find what's in it. And then that can be, you know, that's for articles and essays and discussions about that. We are, in fact, doing that. And some of our volunteers, Deepika and Roshini, under the supervision of Dr. Mark Allens from Sydney Uni, are creating what I believe is the first diplomatic edition of a Buddhist text. And this is the 13th century Dutiya Parakramabahu Chulavaga from the Colombo Museum, which we're typing up. And when that's available, then we'll be able to directly compare that 13th century edition with the modern editions and see whether there are any changes.
Yeah, can I add a few points to that? Yeah, the first thing you said, that you don't feel competent to do that job. I think nobody is competent to make a critical edition. I think that's the problem. And you know, we see throughout Buddhist history, critical editions have been made. I think that's what the Buddhist councils are about. They are really about creating critical editions.
Yeah.
And what you do is you get biased. Those councils, even though they included lots of monks, they are biased by the culture, by that particular culture where the council is. And you can see that in the manuscripts, how headings have been inserted, and those headings have a certain bias, a certain leaning. Yeah, and also the choice of the readings will have been based on that kind of bias. And what happens when you make these kind of council critical editions, other manuscripts tend to be marginalized. They tend eventually to disappear, and then you are left with only that particular reading, and you have lost so much of the richness of the Buddhist culture, which, as you say, would not be lost if you had, as you said, diplomatic editions. I never heard this term before, but it sounds good. Yeah. So I'm going to use that one. If you have diplomatic editions, yeah, you won't lose that, and you have you include that richness for future generations.
Absolutely.
And I think, and what is very important now in our present day is that we don't stop at the Pali Sutta, but we also include the all the EBTs. Yes, if you want to actually have a full understanding of the Pali Suttas, you really have to include the readings from the various Chinese versions of the Sutta, or the Tibetan, or the Sanskrit, or the Gandharan, or the, you know, what's it called, Khotanese, or Sogdian version, or Uyghur version, whatever it is. And that, if you want a really critical edition, if you want to use that general idea, you should bring in readings from way beyond the Pali and include anything that actually has to do with early Buddhist texts.
Right. But to do that would have to be very specialized studies, right? So you could do that with a particular text or a particular passage. You know, and some work has been done in that field with things like Dhammapada texts, where you can compare them and try to reconstruct the original one. But to do that over the whole canon is just absurd. And one of the things also about critical editions is that they are, that the idea of a critical edition is bound up with the idea of the book. The reason that you have critical editions is because you're going to print things as a physical book. And in a physical book, you can make many copies of it, but you can't make many copies of different editions, only one edition with footnotes. And that's the idea of a critical edition. Whereas in digital technology, it's much easier to just create as many different versions as you like and then compare them. And computers are really good at doing that. So it's actually much easier and more native to the digital medium as well.
Hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, good point about the Chinese text and so on. This is another area where the translations are much further behind than they are with the Pali. And we mentioned before, we're helping to sponsor Charles Patton, who's an excellent translator and good friend and scholar colleague. And Chen Meng Tan, one of the sponsors of Sutta Central, has together with Sutta Central, we've set up a fund for giving a stipend for Charles to do his work. And sometimes these things don't take all that much. You know, people aren't looking to, you know, get rich out of this job or anything. They just want to have enough to get by and to be able to do this work. And as a Buddhist tradition, I think that it's really important that we should value this, and we should say that actually this is a not just something which is a sort of a specialist interest or something, but this is like a critical responsibility, a sacred duty of the Buddhist tradition to preserve our texts, to make them available to people, and to show people that this path to liberation is still there and is still available to them. I'll just double check if there are any more questions. I've got a couple more questions. We'll look at the other couple of the questions that are there briefly, and then we'll have to finish up. So from Shiro, how's it going, Shiro? So we wake up Mara, says Sadhu. Well, okay, fine. Okay, Shiro R says, why would you translate names of individuals into their literal meaning that might not make sense? Jiva is translated as that living being. Jiva is still used as a name. It's a good question, and it's not always doesn't always have an obvious answer. But the thing is that in Pali, there's not so much of a distinction between an epithet and a name as there is in English. And so it's quite common that we find that people are being treated, being given a name which is in fact describing the quality which is talked about in that thing. So you have something like, say, Akosaka Bharadvaja, who what really means is angry Bharadvaja. And so it's obviously not really his personal name, it's an epithet. So in some cases like that, I've translated the name because when it brings across the sense in that way. But look, I think that there's a, you know, I don't think there's a right or wrong. I think there's a case to be made to say just keep all of the names in the original language. Okay, so next question. Isn't the Buddha Jayanti compiled in the 60s a critical edition? No. Buddha Jayanti is an edition compiled from some unknown manuscripts in Sri Lanka. There may be some details about that, like the introductions of the Buddha Jayanti edition have some details about the manuscripts and so on, but we don't know a lot about the process that went on. There isn't comparison with Thai and Burmese manuscripts, and the sources of the manuscripts were mostly within the monasteries of that particular Nikaya, as I understand it, that they carried out there. So again, this is kind of like a demi-critical edition, a bit like the Pali Text Society version. You know, there certainly is a critical input and process that's gone on, but it's not what's meant when we talk about a critical edition, where you would have to get representatives from all of the major manuscript traditions across all the Buddhist cultures. You'd have to compare them with the Sanskrit and all of these kinds of things, and that process didn't go on. Okay, Prem. How's it going, Prem? Long time no see. I hope things are going well for yourself and your family. Your efforts not only helpful bringing the same present generation to understand the Dhamma, but future-proofing stability of the teachings. Thank you. And that also is very important for us. And one of the things that we've done in sort of central is always we develop in the open. Everything we do is in the open. All of our data is on GitHub. We encourage anybody to copy it. Please copy it, download it to your computer. Computers break all the time. Everything goes bust all the time. So as many copies, the better we can transfer it. Ananda says, thank you as well. How's sort of central for funding? He had a thing about funding, and that seems to have disappeared. But anyway, we have on the website, we have an option. You can make donations through the website, so that is very much appreciated. At the moment, we're doing another round of development, and we are trying to push through the changes that we talked about earlier to our live site. We've been working on it for more than a year now, and so any support that we can get to bring that to completion is most appreciated. Do we get any funding from BSWA? No, we don't. Members of the BSWA have given us funding, but the BSWA itself not. I think the remit of the BSWA probably wouldn't permit it because it's established for a particular purpose. So most of our funding comes from, all of our funding comes from private donors. Any support is most appreciated to help us do what we need to do. Good. Venerable, do you have any last words?
My last thought is that your work is amazing. Your work is absolutely remarkable, and I have seen the new website, what it looks like behind the scenes, and it's wonderful, and it's much more accessible than before. It's more beautiful than before, and I quite like the idea that, you know, it should look attractive as well, and it looks attractive, and it has so. all I can say is a big, big sadhu to all your really hard work. And thank you for your marvelous contribution. And I hope it doesn't kill you. I hope you, I hope you can carry on in this way. So, yeah. So excellent.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah. And look, yeah, thank you, Venerable. And thank you. I'll just also just briefest of appreciation to Rod and John, who started the project together, Rod Bucknell and John Kelly. To all of those who worked on the project in the past, to Blake, our longtime developer, to Hong Da, more recent developer from China, who's been doing a fantastic job, to STX Next, who's been a firm in Poland we worked together with, and they've been wonderful to work with, to Deepika, who's been helping especially with looking after the financial side of it, to all of our volunteers, Sabamita, Ayurimala, Kaz, Tracy, on and on it goes. Gabriel, so many. And there's like dozens of translators and volunteers and helpers. Also to all of those people on our forum, on our discourse forum, who have pointed out mistakes, typos, who have disagreed with me in my interpretations and who I have reluctantly come to admit sometimes are right. And so, you know, having an open engagement in the forum and having a discussion is also, I think, like a vital part of who we are. And I'm sure there are many people that I haven't mentioned, so please forgive me for not mentioning, but all of those people, all of our donors, all of the people who've been offering sponsorship, and it's really incredible. And without them, we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing. So, yeah, I feel very, very honoured to be able to take part in this. And also just mention finally, once again, Dustin, my dear friend Dustin, and his wife Gecko, who just passed away, and Gecko's family, who sponsored me when I was in Taiwan. With thanks to them. Okay. We should probably finish up about now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, Venerable, you will be hearing from me again soon, and I'll, as usual, be complaining about all the things you've done wrong. How's it going, Kaz? Is there anyone who doesn't have any computer programming skills or much Pali knowledge is a way to help? Get in touch with us through the forum and then ask and see what we can do, because there's always things that can be done, especially like one thing that's really going to be more useful coming forward will be proofreading. And that's something you don't have to be a specialist, but to just help to make it more nice. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bhante. Sadhu. Sadhu.
Sadhu.
Sadhu.